What's up, you guys? Sean Ross Sapp, Fightful Select, the retro review time. Now, I like to plan these as best I can. I mean, sometimes there's no rhyme or reason for why we drop a certain show at a certain time. As we film this, it's actually first week of July. But this retro review matches up with the August theme pretty well, because SummerSlam is supposed to be in Boston. It ain't going to be in Boston. However, WrestleMania 14 is in Boston, and our dude Throwback isn't that far away from Boston. Not like you can tell with that Bengals jersey on.
Come on.
So you picked WrestleMania 14. I would imagine it's near and dear to your heart because it was kind of local to you.
Yeah, especially with the impact with the city. You also got to remember the Red Sox weren't that big. You know, all the major four teams weren't that big. So, like, for me as a 17-year-old kid, you know, this was like a huge thing. This was the ticket that around that time.
Well, I know the Red Sox weren't that big because they took another loss to the Cincinnati Reds on that night as Pete Rose came in and jobbed out the entire city of Boston. It was beautiful. But
it was painful.
It was beautiful. But WrestleMania 14, like a lot of the pay-per-views in that era, I have never watched in full as an adult because I didn't get pay-per-view back then. I didn't order pay-per-views. But this was a big one. This was an integral part in the turning point of the Monday Night Wars and all that, because 19,000 showed up, which, you know, minuscule compared to today's WrestleMania. Well, not this year's, but most years' WrestleMania, because they didn't do it in a stadium. But still, 19,000 cramming into the Fleet Center. Have you been to the Fleet Center?
Yeah, it's actually the Garden.
The Garden now, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, actually there in February for a hockey game.
And they go there all the time now. Like, that's a regular destination for that. I forgot it was even called the Fleet Center. I even forgot that. But this was preceded by No Way Out, No Way Out of Texas, I think it was. They called No Way Out that year. And followed by Unforgiven. Some real interesting shows and a pivotal turning point. Were you watching wrestling as this unfolded back then, or did you become a fan later?
I've been a fan since I was 4. I'm 39. But when in my teens, though, it was one of those things. I was like watching Raw and a little bit of WCW going back and forth, but mainly Raw. So like when they did events after this, they did one at what it's called the Songus Center now. It's Songus Arena. And they did Sunday Night Heat tapings and a Raw taping. I was actually working through that. So I had Austin walk across in the concourse, and I was just starstruck. That's the only time I've been starstruck. They renamed the street on there, too, Stone Cold 316 Way.
Oh, that's
for that
cool
day.
So, I mean, you were, like, what, 17 around the time this happened? So I would imagine a lot of the content was right up your alley at that point. It targeted a lot of teenagers and 20-somethings back then.
Yeah, I was a sophomore in high school.
Man.
I don't look it, though.
So as wrestling evolved from, quite frankly, a lot of cartoonish stuff into this, how were you feeling about that? Because you said you had been a wrestling fan all throughout. How did you feel about the change that you saw? Because this really wasn't something that we had seen before.
No, it was a gradual change. And when it started up like this, I was all for it. It was a little different, a little edgier. It's something that went from like all the cartoons with Diesel and Razor, and now they're all going by, you know, almost their real names, but the storylines were more personal. It was interesting. And then, you know, Steve brought a little bit more edgier, more to your cut thing. And then, you know, you got The Rock going in there as a young kid. It's just that whole roster at that point was just getting developed and it's stacked compared to where it is now.
You mentioned the impact that this had on the city of Boston. I mean, I can remember where, like, every single WrestleMania was, and I remember this is the Boston WrestleMania. They did reference it several times with the Pete Rose thing and the luck of the Irish. Them playing up Ken Shamrock as, like, this big Irishman was one of the funniest things I've seen. I wonder if they would have even done that if his last name was not Shamrock on here. And they were like, well, goddamn, pal, his name's Shamrock. Boston. The Irish. It seems like a Vince thing. But heading into this WrestleMania, was Austin Michaels the thing you were looking most forward to? Because there were some big matches here.
For me, yeah, that was it. But what made it more hype is that a government center in Boston, they actually had a public workout. And the thing was, is that Tyson was in the center of it. And like I said, that was the hot ticket, but the public workout drove, because it wasn't in the Fleet Center. Now, you know,
it was T-Bank.
It was outdoors, and it drew almost 30,000 people into Government Center. And like the commuter rail was completely cramped. It looked like tuna cans. And for me being there, I was in school. I wanted to skip school and go to that badly. And just to be there, and I guess, you know, all bedlam broke loose. They had Austin and Tegel in the ropes and stuff. It was just
they kissed his that cheek, literally, or kissed his head, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And the thing about it financially, this actually drew a lot more money into the city at that point than it had in years. So, I mean, and also with the wrestlers, there's a personal connection with every single one of them. I mean, look at now, you have Sasha, who was in Chaotic Wrestling under Mercedes KV. You had a bunch of people that come through here. It's, you know, a hotbed for talent.
So you mentioned that open workout. I'm glad you brought that up, because it would have completely slipped my mind. That was an integral part of this storyline, this build, because they had Tyson out there. They DX got the better of Steve Austin. And that was also a night in which, or a day, it was an afternoon, which I love that setting, because you don't see a lot of outdoor stuff in the afternoon for WWE, WCW. And this is kind of where some of that started. You would see like a nighttime shot of somebody throwing a belt off a bridge or something like that, but this was the daytime. Also, Shawn Michaels, I think, got hit with a battery or something and like walked out, did not want to do it anymore. And they were able to talk him into coming back. That's covered pretty heavily by WWE. But we did have the kickoff of this show. Chris Warren and the DX Band performing rock versions of America the Beautiful and Star Spangled Banner. The audience did not like this at all. Oh, my God. It's been knocked off of home release. I don't think they put it on the WWE Network. Did you see that at the time, and what did you think?
I was just like the rest of the crowd. It was kind of like, really, you're going to make it look like a crappy version of it when you're supposed to do a good job of it? I mean, yeah, it is what it is, but
I'm not necessarily a respect the flag, stand for the flag guy, but it's just like you could tell they were trying to do this for heel heat. And to me, that's in bad taste. Trying to do this for heel heat, like, and however anybody wants to handle their flag and national anthem stuff, I don't care about that. But to intentionally troll based on that was really weird. This band, though, was iconic in WWE. And a lot of people didn't even know what the band was called. But the DX Band, the Chris Warren Band, unfortunately, we lost Chris Warren in 2016. I wanted to do a big long-form feature on Dale Oliver of TNA, Jim Johnson of WWE, Chris Warren, like a lot of the people who produced music, Jimmy Hart. And as I was getting started on it, Chris Warren passed away. Now, he did themes for DX, Triple H, X-Pac. He did one for the WWF Superstars, Superstars show. He would do some stuff for TNA in, I think it was 07 and 08. What was your favorite theme that group kind of put together?
It was the DX theme.
It was so good.
Yeah. It's one of those things you kept trying to, like, if you remember with cell phones at the time, you got ringtones, you were trying to get, like, you had to record it a certain way and stuff. Or I still had, like, tapes. I wasn't even fully in CDs yet. So literally, I would literally try to tape it. It walked through the speakers and stuff like that and try to get it matched up, right? And it never worked. Annoyed the crap out of my mom, though.
I was lucky enough to finally get a CD player like around 98, 99, and I got WWF The Music Volume 4. And I think that had, I think it had the Triple H theme on it, which had a lot of inside stuff, like Chris Warren references Kevin Dunn, which I was like, oh my God, he referenced Kevin Dunn. What the? We're not supposed to hear about that. Like, so And then the I also like the Run DMC version of the DX theme. I thought that one was really, really good that came out the following year. But to use this as troll bait and heel heat, I was like, that's in real bad taste. Even back then, I loved DX, but I was like, man, this it's so lame. It's so lame. Well, we got a tag team battle royal to kick this off, and it only lasted 8 minutes. There were like 30 people in this match. Let's run them down. Phineas Godwin and Henry Godwin. What are your favorite Godwin memories?
There's not much.
Not much. Not no. much there. Steve Blackman and Flash Funk. What a weird combination that is. I love Flash Funk. Two Gold Scorpio was one of my favorite wrestlers. You have the Disciples of Apocalypse, 8-Ball and Skull, which were the Harris Brothers. You have Too Much, Scott Taylor and Brian Christopher, before they were Too Cool. I would have never imagined at this point that they would have been so over.
Yeah, and it's just funny how you see the progression of them, too. Also, you had, what was it? You had a bunch of Hall of Famers in this, yeah. too.
The Rock and Roll Express, Ricky Morton, Robert Gibson. Weird to see them there. The Headbangers, Mosh and Thrasher. Another team that I liked, but just I liked them as a mid-card tag team. I thought that was fine.
You had Farouk and the Godfather in there, too.
Yep, Farouk and Kama Mustafa were in there, and I like that team. That's a hell of a team to have in there.
Mark Henry.
Yeah, Los Barriquas, Savio Vega, and Miguel Perez. Another combination of Jose Estrada and Jesus Castillo, which was a little confusing to me. That you had, you had like two combinations of Los Barriquas, two of Nation of Domination. At times, I was like, wait, which one is teaming with which one? But you also had the Truth Commission, Recon, and Sniper. I think that Recon eventually became Bull Buchanan. A random one, which I love, Bradshaw and Chains. Chains mm-hmm. was Brian Lee, the fake Undertaker. I would not have hated to see that team do a little bit more. I think that kind of would have been okay.
Yeah, but it also, since they departed, it made it easier for, you know, Bradshaw and Farouk to get together.
Very true.
And look what they ended up doing.
Yeah, that's better than anything that Bradshaw and Chains were going to do. And then we had the Quebecers, Jacques Rougeau and PCO, now known as PCO. I forgot they were even here. Forgot they were even here at this point.
I didn't even see them in the match.
Yeah, they're just listed. I don't remember them like at all. I don't remember them at all. They're listed as nondescript entrants. But then we got the team, LOD 2000. Now, I was a giant Legion of Doom Road Warriors fan. I loved them. I even liked when Draws was with them, but they've got Sonny with them here. What did you think of this rebirth of LOD with Sonny and with the new gear?
New gear was sick, especially with the newer version, updated hockey mask they were using.
I thought that was badass.
Yeah. And you don't see those anymore. They're not as common in hockey right now. But with Sonny, it put more eyes at that point because Sonny was red hot at that point. So, I mean, every teenager wanted to date her and every woman wanted to be around her. So it was just interesting. And plus, you know, LOD, it's enough said, especially now we know more after Dark Side of the Ring too.
Yeah.
It puts more emphasis on their or later matches because of the fact that, you know, Hawk left in the 2000s. So it makes you appreciate more stuff like that.
Well, I definitely think LOD 2000 was the right choice to win this match. They brought him in with all the pomp and circumstance. Like you said, the gear was so awesome. Mm-hmm. That like gray and the one big spike and the helmets. I had the action figures when I saw that. I was like, I got to go get those. But the thing is, the action figures had the old gear on them. And I was like, ah, man, they had the helmets, but they had the old spikes. Now, they last eliminated the New Midnight Express, which was Bodacious Bart and Bombastic Bob. Two of the worst names I have ever heard. And they were teaming with Jim Cornette. And all this does is show you that Sonny is a much better manager than Jim Cornette.
Yeah, especially with Cornette ranting and raving all the time.
Yeah,
you don't hear much from Sonny that much other than the scandal stuff here and there.
She says some pretty stupid shit on her own, but I love LOD winning this match. It was only 8 minutes, but how long can you run a battle royal like this? This was really one of the first let's get everybody on the show type of battle royals, and I'm okay with that, but how do you feel about these the battle royals they put on these?
You don't see them that much anymore, well, as much as they're prevalent. Yeah, but you know, it's interesting to see how many tag teams want to be on top. Pardon the pun with Sonny, but the thing about it is that it helps get eyes on them. I mean, look at with the product now, you don't see many people on there, obviously with COVID, but still, you know, having Ruby on gets eyes on her. So having all these teams that are not being used at that point, it gives them eyes and people notice them.
So, the match, it was what it was. It was all right. But then we got Taka Michinoku against Aguila. Now, if those of you might go, who the hell's Aguila? Who the hell's Aguila? Well, you might remember him as S.A. Rios or Papi Chulo. At this point, allegedly, he was like 19, 20, 21. His age is disputed. On commentary, I think they mentioned 20, 21. Some places list him as 19. With ages in stuff like this, he could have been 24 or 25 for all we know. He was not what he was going to be as S.A. Rios, who I thought was just an unbelievable performer, who brought in Lita. Taka Michinoku was real good at that point. I mean, 24 years old, and I mean, his finish, I love the Michinoku driver. He was well-traveled already. But this was a very short match. I feel like they could have went a couple more minutes, like 7.5, 8 even. Well, what would you think about this?
Actually, this match was pretty good. I thought it was really good just because, you know, with all the high flying and stuff, you know, Aguila with the corkscrew poncho. But, and just all the different things. Ross said at one point he was pointing out about Logan Airport saying they're flying off, like, and they have to notify Logan Airport. So, I mean, there were like a lot of Boston undertones in this match talking about what they were doing. But this match was really good.
Yeah.
As much as it short was, it was really good.
Now, obviously, WWE got the short end of the stick on the light heavyweight division. And that's of their own doing, by the way. There was talent out there that they could have went and got. But their tournament that happened, I can't remember. I think it was December they did the tournament. It was Flash Flanagan, who was an OVW regular, who actually appeared on WWE a couple, maybe a year and a half ago. And do you remember the Nation's Battle Royal or whatever it was that Baron Corbin won? Flash
yeah.
Flanagan was in that. You had Brian Christopher. He was not Grandmaster Sexay yet. Scott Taylor was not Scotty Too Hotty yet. Nobody knows who the hell Eric Shelley is. They did, however, have a pretty good top half of the bracket. They had Aguila, who, again, was not S.A. Rios yet. Super Loco, who was not quite Super Crazy yet. Devin Storm, who was not quite Crowbar yet. And Taka Michinoku. So the thing is, like, if you had put this together, this roster, about 2 years later, you would have looked at this and been like, damn, that's a good tournament. But when they did, a lot of these guys just weren't ready, and the light heavyweight division wasn't ready. And by the end of that year, by the end of 98, they gave up on it. They put the title on Gilbert.
Yeah, that was kind of funny.
I mean, it was
with
funny.
The sparkles and stuff, but it was wrong.
Yeah, I thought it was funny, but then he held it all throughout 99 and didn't. Actually, the guy Gilbert lost it to was Aguila on Sunday Night Heat in February of 2000. What, do you have any, like, fond memories of that light heavyweight division before it got integrated into the cruiserweight division?
Yeah, just a lot of Taka.
Yeah.
Literally just a lot of it because he was carrying it all the time.
I didn't appreciate him as I should have.
But I appreciated him a lot just because it all the wear and tear he had to do, all these moves he was pulling out. You know, to quote a line from here, it was wicked pretty good.
Oh, son of a bitch. Son of a bitch. Up next, for the European Championship, I miss this title. What were your thoughts on the European title?
It was really good. the segment before too was pretty good with Jennifer Flowers and with all the stuff with Clinton too. But this was like, it had so much comedy. It was really brutal. It was really physical. They played off the story of Owen's ankle. It, especially with Owen being gone, this kind of made it more sentimental. You know, there was a lot of people that are no longer with us in the in this review, but it, it makes you appreciate their work a lot more.
Well, what did you think of the European title in general, like just the championship? I wish they would have held it around a lot longer. I wish it was still around today. I wish that the European title was a mid-card title for NXT UK or something.
I think it should be in NXT, period.
Yeah.
It should still be around, because if you look at the list of people, I mean, obviously Hunter had it at this point, but you had D'Lo holding it at point. It was just a stepping stone to its stepping stone. So if you had to look at it differently, the European title was one step closer to the IC title because the United States title wasn't around at that point. It was almost counterintuitive to the United States title when it was in WCW.
I just liked how it looked too. For some reason, I liked that big red banner that they had on it. But do you remember how Triple H won this title?
Yeah.
Shawn Michaels fell down and Triple H hit the ropes like six times and then just fell on him and won. Really good. But I agree with you. I thought this was pretty good. Actually, one of the better in-ring matches on the show. Really physical. You had China throwing powder, hitting Owen with a low blow. China revolutionized the low blow. Like, when she started to throw low blows from behind, it was such a good camera shot. She hit them so well. She really did make the low blow a more devastating move. And this is where we're leading to, like, China becoming a major, major character as well.
Yeah, basically predominant, too, especially with the whole thing with Sergeant Slaughter, too, being handcuffed to Slaughter the entire time.
That was a good that was a good element. I thought that was really cool.
It made it really interesting just to see, like, he had to try to restrain her the entire time, because that angle going into it, she was basically intervening in every match they were having, especially with Owen, and it just handcuffing her when she didn't want to be was awesome.
Now, we talk a lot about, like, oh, what if Brett hadn't left? What if the screw job didn't happen? I think Owen probably still ends up facing Triple H at WrestleMania. I think that it wouldn't be as babyface heel. It'd be a little more both there, because DX and the Hart Foundation were both like tweeners, so to speak, depending on where they were. If Brett hadn't left, do you think that this match still would have happened, or do you think other plans would have unfolded?
I think this match would have happened, but I think later on the line, Owen would have been champion.
I do too.
Like, he literally would have been, like, WWE champion and probably ran with it a little bit until he met up with Austin. But, you know, how everything landed just seemed perfect at that point.
We had Mark Marrow and Sable defeating the artist formerly known as Gold Dust and Luna Vachon. This went 9 minutes, 11 seconds. By the way, Triple H, Owen Hart, 11 and a half minutes. But I feel like about 2 or 3 of the minutes that went into this match could have went into Taka and Aguila. I didn't need to see that much. I was not into Goldust then. This was one of my least favorite periods of Goldust. I always love Luna Vachon. I think that she is just such an out-there, eccentric character. But Sable was becoming the hottest thing in wrestling besides Steve Austin and Goldberg. From a women's standpoint, there's a real good argument to be made that until really the last couple of years, Sable might have been the most single popular female character in WWE history. Explain to me your thoughts that you had going into this match. And I mean, there's a lot to unpack here, obviously.
Well, first things first, the narrating. You wouldn't believe that was a young Michael Cole actually narrating all that stuff. Sable was... God, is Sable. At that point, it was like literally a fight between her and Sonny. At that point, being a teenager, you're like, which one would you want to date at that point? But Sable was like nuclear at that point, and the match was... It was okay, but it could have been better. I mean, the ending was pretty decent. I mean, the same finisher getting hit twice on two different people, though.
So. Yeah, and so I'll say this. Sable doing the Sable Bomb, which we would later see her do on Marrow months later, I believe it is. I mean, that was iconic, but it also prevented Marrow from ever working with Steve Austin. Did you ever hear that story?
No, I didn't.
Steve Austin was supposed to work with Mark Marrow at one point, and Mark Marrow took a Sable Bomb from Sable, and Austin said, well, you can tell him that's not happening now, because how am I going to sell for him? He just got powerbombed by a 120-pound woman, and that didn't end up happening. Sable, though, at this point, like I said, this was about Sable and Luna. Goldust and Mark Marrow were basically there to help hide the fact that Sable could not work very well. All things considered, though, the benefit of having such a hot crowd really made this pretty fun. I thought it was a lot better than I expected going into this, because Sable was never a good worker. Luna was. Goldust was. Mark Marrow, yeah, kind of. But I thought they did a really good job of hiding her deficiencies and keeping her in the match, because, like I said, she was the person people were there to see in this match.
Yeah, pretty much. And the three of them, Luna, Goldust, Marrow, were hiding her inadequacies, like you said. But also, like, the crowd was literally just doing catcalls half the time, too. Yeah. So, I mean, it makes you see, like, the evolutions of the women's wrestling movement, too, and where it is now compared to then. And it makes you appreciate what we have rather than what we don't.
So I thought that the show kicked off with a few really good matches. The Battle Royal wasn't supposed to be a good match. It was supposed to be a moment. And it was a moment, because I still remember it. Aguila and Taka, pretty good. Owen Hart and Triple H, good. And then this tag match was better than I thought. Then we got we'll group this in, but the Jennifer Flowers Rock interview. This was, like, you could tell, The Rock was really coming into his own here.
Yeah, he was literally actually where he was going to be a couple of years ago. The funny part is, I remember, is that the lead up to a lot of his stuff, he was getting on TRL a lot more, if you remember. Yeah. Total.
Oh, and it was huge. TRL was gigantic
at that point, and him being on it as a host periodically helped him out too. But him trying not to reference the Bill Clinton stuff, it makes you laugh. And he starts going into, and he's like, wait a minute, whoa, I can't do this. Yeah. But he wants to. It's funny as hell. And now you see him now. And
a lot of the jokes they made on commentary, it's like, whoa. I couldn't imagine them referencing an act like the active president like that. Well, especially because it's Vince's boy. But mm-hmm. Like, it's just weird to look back at that, and they would always try to hit topical things like that. And that leads into the Intercontinental title match. But before that, Tennessee Lee brings out Jeff Jarrett and Jennifer Flowers. Now, here's the thing. When Jennifer Flowers first sauntered out with him, my vision's not great. I was like, oh, Deborah was here? But it wasn't Deborah. Deborah, another person who would be massively over. But to me, it was a little weird to see Jeff Jarrett here in that character again, because Jeff Jarrett went in and out of the WWF so many times. They brought him in the early 1990s, the mid-1990s. He left in 95, or left in 96, I believe it is. Came back in 08 after, or 98 after the WCW run. He left again in 99. And was not back until he came back as a producer. So he had like three runs each in WCW and WWF. But at no point, really, until like late 98 or 99 was he over. And that's when he cut his hair and he did the don't piss me off thing. And you had Deborah and puppies. It's just weird to see this and them thinking that this would fit in the Attitude Era, because it very clearly did not fit in.
No, it felt awkward. Definitely awkward.
It was. It just wasn't good. Well, I'll tell you what else is awkward. That goddamn chair shot to Ken Shamrock's head. Oh, my God, man. So the thing of this was that The Rock would try to get DQ'd to retain his Intercontinental title. So if he got DQ'd Shamrock won the title. Now, The Rock could get counted out, which he tried to do. And he had D'Lo and Kama and Mark Henry all there. But Shamrock won this with an ankle lock in like 4 minutes. 4 or 5 minutes. And whipped The Rock's ass. Like, he beat The Rock's ass here. I was a little surprised looking back at this, that this was so one-sided.
Yeah, and then you have Farooq coming out.
Yes.
Out of nowhere and just be like, he's begging for help. You know, Rock's asking for help. And he just stands back, turns his back, and walks away. Which started a program with them right afterwards, too.
So, yeah, I was surprised that, one, Shamrock dominated this so much, and that he won so quickly. Now, he holds on to the ankle lock, and as you mentioned, Farooq comes down. There had been a power struggle here within the Nation of Domination. Fun fact, I collect Nation of Domination Jack's Pacific Bone Cruncher figures.
That's awesome.
I need D'Lo and the Godfather. I'm about to buy that two-pack very soon. But they represent a lot of this era to me, the Nation of Domination. I mean, Crush, Savio Vega, Farooq, The Rock, even PG-13, D'Lo Brown, Mark Henry, The Godfather. Like, a lot of people benefited from this. Savio Vega and Crush got their own groups out of this. Like, they got their own biker groups and Los Boricuas out of this. When you think back to the Nation of Domination, what do you remember?
Just very, very talented people. Like, immensely. Especially with Henry coming out of the Olympics 2 years prior. D'Lo being obviously, you know, amazing at that point. Once all of them got together, especially after the Rocky Maivia stuff, after everything, these guys went off. Especially when, did you see Mark Henry's Stone Cold episode yet?
I haven't. I'm going to this weekend, though.
He referred to being under Ron Simmons' tree like a golden age. Oh, like, God. All of them just launched right afterwards. Then, because after this, and they all broke up, Henry was Sexual Chocolate. D'Lo was his own person. Rock shot up. And then, you know, Farooq ended up being in the Alkalites with Bradshaw, the APA. It was
everybody
literally
benefited.
All of them. Yeah.
Everybody.
You don't see that often.
Do you remember when D'Lo was a part of the original Nation of Domination and he was just one of the bodyguards? I was like, oh, he's just a jobber. He's there to get beaten up. So when they kept him, because I remember when Farooq fired the whole nation and he's like, not you, you're staying, to D'Lo. And I was like, oh man, that means something. Ron mm-hmm. Simmons saying that means something, even as a character. And to your point, who do you ever hear say anything bad about Ron Simmons?
You don't. He's still the only person, I believe, that's got the inducted into the Florida State Hall of Fame.
Oh, wow. I forgot about that. So he comes out and they start that split. And how do you feel about them reversing the decision? Because he held on to the hold. Now, I get it. They used to do that a lot. They don't do that anymore. Shamrock ended up beating up a bunch of refs. Also, I don't like his belly-to-belly suplex. He's so much more talented than using that as like his setup, secondary finish. I'm glad he switched to the ankle lock. But I hate the reversing of the decision, even though you kind of had to sort of thing. Like, because he won that. And it's hard for me to look at that and say, The Rock won that match when he got his ass whipped so bad.
Yeah, and then you see Pat Patterson right before that in the ring. Shamrock's like all out ballistic mad, and you could see it in his eyes. Patterson just ekes out. And this is before the whole thing with Austin and Vince and, you know, where they're going through all that. And literally he just scurries off once he sees it. But wow, what a butt whipping that was, especially on the stage. For the band stage, wow. Like, yeah. He wouldn't let go.
Yeah, Shamrock, I think he could have been so good. He could have been so good. And it's a shame. I mean, he's still wrestling today, which is crazy. Still wrestling today, but a lot of potential there. He'd be gone in a year and a half, unfortunately. Oh boy, the dumpster match for the WWF Championship. This was nuts. Cactus Jack and Chainsaw Charlie defeated the New Age Outlaws, Billy Gunn and Road Dogg to become tag team champions. Cactus Jack and Chainsaw Charlie, I think, are heavily responsible for the initial success of the New Age Outlaws, because before, this was Rockabilly and Jesse James, the roadie. These guys came into their own, and working with Cactus Jack and Chainsaw Charlie helped them. It gave them some legitimacy to me, and there were some crazy spots here. How did you feel about this?
This match was freaking awesome.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, it was killer. The whole with the dumpster and stuff, them trying to throw him in there. The finish itself, people are usually redo that now. You see using the forklift and stuff like that. But, I mean, the baking sheets, everything, you know, the mandible claw on Gunn, and, you know, literally you see Foley at his finest when the stakes are this high. I mean, Hell in a Cell getting tossed up, he still got up. That guy is, like, one tough SOB. Everybody says Austin is the toughest son of a bitch, but I'm not even kidding. You have to look at Foley better than that.
That spot off the ladder, out of the ring, into the dumpster, there's not a lot of margin for error there. You're going to crack your head on the side of a dumpster or your leg on the edge of the dumpster, and there's not really a way to protect that. I do love that Jim Ross is like, you got some guy drinking a beer somewhere saying they know how to fall. I love that. I love when he would go off about that. This was prime JR, too.
Yeah, it was in his wheelhouse, and then you have King like screaming, oh my God, literally every time something happens. I mean, the ladder itself, the covers were still closed on that dumpster, and they incaved the entire time. So, obviously, they had to use a different dumpster to finish the match.
Yeah.
But it was literally insane. If they brought the hardcore title into that moment, that would make it more easier to understand. But these matches were, like, out of this world.
Yeah, it was weird to see the titles on the line where you gotta lock somebody in a dumpster. But they had built a full storyline around this dumpster stuff. And I thought it was pretty good. It was interesting. It was different. Because at this point of that show, we had a battle royal, we had a bunch of singles matches, and we had a mixed tag match. We didn't have anything like the dumpster match. In fact, this was completely opposite of what we had just seen, where the decision got reversed because somebody beat him up too bad. This was the complete opposite of that. So I think that this show needed that change of pace.
Yeah, it was exactly the way it's supposed to be. This match was, like, killer. And then it brings up the next one, too, where it's two different styles of stories, but God, you know, between these four, it almost stole the show if the main event wasn't the way the main event was.
Well, we had the co-main event, so to speak, The Undertaker defeating Kane. At this point, I did not know who Kane used to be. At what point did you figure out that Kane used to be Isaac Yankem and the fake Diesel?
Actually, not till he set it out on himself with whole Nair thing. Yeah, I just thought it was just, you know, I kept this. I believe I was fully into the story.
Yeah,
like at this point for me, if it's got a good story, like on a TV show or anything like that, I'm fully invested into it. So like something like, you know, Taker saying it's his brother, they're finding out it was his brother and all that stuff. It was like, wow, this is the other side, we didn't see him. Now with the documentary, you see like how close they really are in life.
Yeah.
So, and then I know you're going to say this, but then Pete Rose before that.
Oh yeah. God. Oh yeah. So Pete Rose comes out and trolls the city of Boston just like they deserve. As you can see, Throwback is a giant fan of Cincinnati sports. So he was very excited to see this. The Cincinnati Reds are the, that's terrible. Let's edit that out. Let's just put a big blur over that. But Pete Rose comes out and gets tombstoned. Kane would do this like three straight years. I loved that. Pete Rose seemed like he was a gamer and seemed like he was Howard Finkel. announcing him as a surefire Hall of Famer. That was good. But with Kane, the thing is, he was a heel a couple of these times, and still they would do this, which I thought was kind of fun, that they were like, Kane, big badass heel, beating up another heel. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was awesome. It really is. The whole crowd popped right when Rose got the tombstone, though. Like, you could hear it, just the whole thing become quiet and just bang.
So Kane had been around for a while. He was Isaac Yankem DDS in 95, a little bit of 96. He came back as the fake Diesel at the end of 96, some of 97. Then we got off TV and he came back as Kane. It's a good thing they stuck with him. It's a good thing they saw it out with him. Because this character has been one of WWE's greatest reinventions ever, Kane. He's got Paul Bearer out there. The match, I do feel like the match could have been a couple minutes shorter. It was, by the way, the dumpster match went 10 minutes. This match was okay. It would drag at some points, but then there were some big spots, like throwing into the table and all that. How did you feel about how this match unfolded and how it played out?
Believe it or not, this was really good, especially it progressed the storyline. But now you have iconic images. Yes. With the druids and stuff like that. So when they do the playbacks on stuff with, you know, Taker, you see them in Boston doing it. Later on in the later match with Austin, one of the things they show is him holding the title. That gets replayed, and that was in Boston too. But
facing off too. That's iconic. Yeah. That image has been around ever since then.
Yeah, literally. It was insane. Extremely physical, extremely well written. You don't get these storylines that much. Like, the electric chair drop was kind of like a botch bat a little bit. But, you know, Bear, you know, kicking Taker and stuff was funny. You know, the ending was really good, but it primarily just made the story more invested, and it was really something to see. You don't see many really good stories written that much anymore.
And the thing is, they had been building this match since May of the previous year. On May 12th, 1997, Mankind brought back Paul Bearer, who tried to reunite with The Undertaker and gave him the ultimatum, saying that he's got The Undertaker's biggest secret. So that's May.
Mm-hmm.
May. And it went all the way to March 29th, 1998, before they had their first match. And The Undertaker did not want to do this match. The character did not want to do this match. He didn't want to fight his brother. He didn't want to do all that. And, hey, at the time, I was like, okay, Kane's here. He's going to beat The Undertaker. And they've got a new Undertaker type of thing. It's probably a good thing in retrospect that that didn't happen, because they did the streak, and that was a major... major drawing point of WrestleMania in the years that followed. And Kane would be a part of several of those matches. But I think they did the right thing having Undertaker beat Kane here.
Yeah, but at that point, nobody kicked out of the tombstone at that point, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, and, I don't believe so.
And in this match, it happened twice.
And that's the thing. They weren't mirror images of each other, but the styles were. Also, thing that I noticed in this match, how freaking big Kane is. Mm-hmm. Jesus! His arms are huge! Huge! He's
jacked.
he's one of those guys I always hear is like underrated, one of the strongest guys in wrestling. He picked up Big Show and tossed him over the top rope one time, and it was a beautiful spot. But while I wouldn't say that this was the first, second, third, maybe even fourth best match of the night, the story is what this was about, Pat.
Yeah, I know, right? Especially it built so long. And I think the only closest story to that was Cena and Rock, because they waited a year to face each other.
Yeah, like, there might be some more, but I would have to really think about that. But they dragged this out, and they should have.
Yeah. Well, that's why, you know, compared that to Cena and Rock, because you also had that back then. There was not much social media. You know, the internet was around, but you didn't have like Twitter, Facebook, and stuff like that. So it's like, you know, compared to where it is now, and you had for Rock and Cena, they had the entire build-up for a full year, and they're using their social media and stuff. They're talking trash between each other. Just imagine how long this story and how good this story, if social media was back then. That would be insane.
I wonder if it would have taken away from it. If somebody online would have been like, oh, you know this is the fake Diesel, right? Like, it's not really Kane. Here's a picture of him without his mask on. Like, I wonder how that would have played out. That's an interesting thing to look at, how social media would have helped or hurt stories back then. But it wasn't around back then, and this ruled. This was, again, a little bit too long, maybe a couple minutes could have made it better. But looking back, it's an iconic moment. You got those images, and WrestleMania is about the moments.
Yeah, the hot spots where everybody's all excited about it.
Then it happened. Stone Cold Steve Austin defeated Shawn Michaels for the WWF Championship. Mike Tyson is the special enforcer. Triple H and China are with Shawn Michaels. Now, Shawn Michaels had not wrestled at this point since Royal Rumble. And he had injured his back, and he would be gone after this for 4.5 years. Do I think that he could have come back sooner? Yes. I definitely think he could have come back sooner. He wrestled matches. I think he wrestled a match in Texas at his wrestling school in between this, like in late 99 or maybe mid 99 or something. He could have come back a lot sooner. But after this, we didn't see Michaels for 4.5 years till SummerSlam 02. WCW would not be around by then. Stone Cold Steve Austin's career was effectively over by the time Michaels came back. Because when Shawn Michaels came back, Austin had walked out. He would come back, have two matches, and leave. So Shawn Michaels missed an entire era. How do you think that 98 to 02 would have been with Shawn Michaels there? Because here's the thing. There's a very good chance that he wouldn't have cleaned up if he stayed around.
Yeah, no, he would have just deteriorated to a point where they would have to put him in rehab or something like that. He would try to be subpar, but he'd be a shadow of himself. So, but where he was towards the twilight, it made those two matches with Taker even more special.
And the thing is, this match, like, you could tell Shawn Michaels was hurting. But he put on such a great performance with that injured back and did everything he could to make Steve Austin look good. And Shawn Michaels was a little problematic back then. There are always those stories about how Taker saw Shawn Michaels coming in and, like, was taping his hands up after his match, like, or making sure that Shawn Michaels did the job right, or else he was going to kind of make Shawn Michaels do the job. I loved how they had the DX band play Shawn Michaels out. Really awesome. But then they used, like, the drum set and all that stuff, too.
Yeah, the other thing also was that because Hebner was sick at that time, and if you look at when they were before the match in their entrance, Shawn's like, this is for you, Hebner. And the camera shot where they're pulling out and Austin's coming around the corner almost looks like a Goldberg-esque entrance, and Shawn did it, too. But the image that sets in is the Austin one where he walks around the corner and it just focuses straightly on him and there's nothing behind him. The match itself was god awful awesome. Like, you know, Austin put a hit doing the Irish whip to Shawn into the dumpster, you know, everybody flipping off the camera periodically too. Nowadays it would be all, you know, 5 second delay. It was just literally one thing after the other.
It was a really fitting main event. Went 20 minutes and might have been match of the night. Might have been match of the night. And the thing is, I'll never remember this as like one of the greatest WrestleMania matches of all time. But you have to remember it as one of the greatest WrestleMania moments of all time. And it's something that I keep mentioning, the WrestleMania moment. This show had LOD coming back as LOD 2000. And hey, what happened after that? Whatever. But that was a moment. It had the dumpster match, which had a lot of cool stuff. It had Kane, Undertaker, and it had Shawn Michaels and Steve Austin, and they wrapped this up in about 2 hours, 45 minutes, maybe 3 hours. This wasn't like a 4, 5, 6 hour marathon like we saw today. This capped off what I thought was a very easy to watch show.
Yeah, it was really, really fun. I mean, especially with, you know, freaking Tyson punching Shawn after everything. Just, and now you look at it where he's trying to do stuff in AEW, it makes you appreciate the younger version of himself rather than where he is now with the tattoos and stuff. But a lot of the spots, like the figure four, Shawn using the ropes, you don't see people doing that much. You know, just reversing the figure four in general. There's a lot of good spots in this match and a lot of interesting things that came afterwards.
So Mike Tyson makes the quick count. By the way, poor Mike Chioda's head. He got it smashed in like 3 times. Poor Mike Chioda. But Tyson makes the count. Austin gives him a shirt. They speculate, oh, was it a plan from the beginning? But that punch that Mike Tyson threw to Shawn Michaels was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you see the difference. And the thing is, like, oh, it was such a good, it was a good technical punch, and it was a good working punch too, because you could tell that he didn't really hit Shawn Michaels, but Shawn Michaels bumped his ass off for this.
He sold it like crazy.
He did. And sometimes selling it like crazy is just taking the bump and laying there. Because that's the thing. If Mike Tyson punches you, you're getting knocked out. You're not going to roll around on the ground and flip around. You're going to go flat. I thought it was perfect.
It was awesome, especially with the buildup with him being the baddest man on the planet and stuff. He wasn't even in a factor for the most of the match, too, until the end of it. Literally, it was just interesting to see, like, them playing off, like, oh, you know, he's going to be on DX's side, da-da-da, he's going to be the factor, whatever happens, it's going to be on their side, and then it just 360s it, especially with the ending.
Shawn Michaels would become the commissioner by the end of this year. He was done wrestling. He did some announcing. He was never better than when he was a wrestler. That's the thing. They tried him in a lot of different roles. Even today, as a producer, agent, coach, he was the best as a wrestler, and there ain't nothing wrong with that because he's one of the best there was. The next night, Triple H kicks him out of DX, brings back X-Pac, mm-hmm. introduces the New Age Outlaws. So this launches that, the new DX, which took things to even greater heights. Chainsaw Charlie would eventually just become Terry Funk again and wouldn't be much of a factor. Cactus Jack would become Dude Love and feud with Steve Austin. It's so funny to think that immediately after this, Steve Austin got the newer championship, because I've seen this image of Steve Austin holding up this title so many times that when I think of Steve Austin as champion, I think of this title belt. What did you think about the switch from the original Winged Eagle to the updated one?
It was awesome.
It was a good title. I thought it was still a good title.
And then the Broken Skull title too.
Yeah.
Those were interesting. You know, just to see the progression of it, and now they ended up going with the spinner later on, and now the title style has completely changed. It's an evolution. It's always going to be a process, no matter what. But they should have kept that belt that Austin won and just made it more special, and then all of a sudden showed a new one later on that year, but they didn't.
I wasn't a big fan of the Smoking Skull back then, but it made sense for him. It made a lot of sense for him. LOD... they fizzled out. They fizzled out, unfortunately. Sable did not fizzle out. Sable became a gigantic star, and we'll quickly run through as we wrap up the results of the next month's pay-per-view. Farouk, Ken Shamrock, and Steve Blackman. So this was Farouk leaving the Nation, Ken Shamrock, who had problems with The Rock, and Steve Blackman, who was just there, defeating the Nation in 13 minutes, 30 seconds. My God.
Mm-hmm.
Triple H defeated Owen Hart in a European title match, 12 and a half minutes. Bombastic Bob and Bodacious Bart defeated the Rock and Roll Express in about 7 minutes, with the NWA World Tag Team Championships on the line. Luna Vachon defeated Sable in under 3 minutes in an evening gown match. Oh, boy. The New Age Outlaws had regained the tag titles and defeated LOD 2000, which to me, it's like, damn, this is the result that sticks out to me. It's like, on one hand, the New Age Outlaws are about to be one of the hottest acts in wrestling. On the other hand, LOD, you're trying to get them to be one of the hottest acts in wrestling again. How do you think, they should have went with LOD 2000 there, or they should have went as they did with the New Age Outlaws?
They should have gave LOD a little bit more push than they did, and then later half of the year, just in 1998, give, you know, the New Age Outlaws the titles and let them run fully, because that way it gives them a little more polish, more shine. But everything happens for a reason, and it went the way it did.
The Undertaker would defeat Kane in an Inferno match. That's another one. Not like 16 minutes, not a great match, but the moment, Pat, the moment is what you remember.
Yeah, they were even talking about this when he was on the Broken Skull, you know, Kane, that they had to do this stunt over and over again just to get it right. And they had to put flame retardant stuff on his arm. So they planned that out. But everybody was more worried about them getting burnt. But every time they hit that mat, those flames went higher and higher. And then when he leapt off of the Taker, I was just like insanely like glued to it.
Dude Love defeated Stone Cold Steve Austin via disqualification. Oh, boy. So that was Unforgiven the following month as well. That kind of puts a bow on WrestleMania 14. I am so glad that you recommended this show, because a lot of these shows from this era, again, I didn't get a chance to go back and watch and pay attention to. Tell me your favorite moment from this show. What sticks out to you? And if it's Austin, give me a secondary one.
It's kind of hard. I mean, for me, it's Owen.
God,
he was so amazing. But the one thing that sucks out, and it's not the pay-per-view, it's the impact of the city. At that time, Boston was kind of reeling back because of all the sports. There's some of the stuff inside the city and outskirts, you know, around here, especially where I'm from. My city that I live in, it's Lowell. They were still rebuilding and try to get it up the infrastructure from, you know, there's a documentary called Cracktown USA, and it's about the city and about the epidemic on that. So they're trying to change their image. Boston's trying to change the image. So this coming in came in perfectly. This was actually the perfect setting. Boston's always been a huge wrestling town, wrestling city. I mean, it's just the impact of the infrastructure for them. It created more jobs, created more everything, more push. Inside the pay-per-view, Owen.
Yeah.
It's just simple as that. Austin Michaels changed the complexity of everything. But with as many matches we would have with Owen later on, it makes you realize how good he was and how special he was.
You guys can check out Throwback every Tuesday at youtube.com/throwback27. Tell the people a little bit about what you do. You started a show, again, given positive feedback, positive reinforcement, constructive criticism. I can't tell you guys how important that is to improving. There might be things that we do and we don't notice that you all like them or don't like them. But tell the people what you're doing every week.
Primarily, you're just going to review from when NXT is all the way to Raw. And then sometimes we'll throw in a little bit of, you know, gaming stuff if there's something prevalent. The chat's insane. You know, there's certain people literally there working out, doing their own stuff. And then, you know, the whole thing with Warren's in there, if you ever want to say hi to him, the whole Justice for DGMC thing that's going on.
Absurd. But it's crossing brands now.
It's one of those things, like, we'll go through all that stuff. I've talked about in past episodes some personal things that I've gone through, that some misconceptions with epilepsy and stuff. You know, I'm an open book, so I try to let people into my life, and wrestling does that. You know, if the logo itself speaks for itself, you know, being a Dragon Ball fan, and everybody's like looking at me, they one person's like, why that? If you ever watched the show or that anime, It's two main people constantly fighting to be the best. In wrestling, there's always, in a story, two people constantly fighting to be the best. You know, and they're trying to grow stronger, get bigger, and the storylines are more in-depth. Same thing with an anime. It's the same premise, but Dragon Ball is one of the big ones that everybody is known just by the name.
Yeah.
So wrestling to me is the same thing story-wise as that. If you get a good story like an anime,
there you go.
It's you get it, you sink your teeth into a wrestling story. Other than that, we'll talk about anything in general. I mean, we were talking about pizza the other night.
Sometimes that's the hot topic, man. Sometimes that's like what people want to talk about, like fruit or Pop-Tarts or pizza. You got to rock with it.
Or just basketball or hockey or anything. I even say sometimes to some of my friends, my show is an open forum. I'll review everything and we'll talk about it. But if there's time and anybody in the chat brings stuff, we'll talk about that too. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, I always tell like people like Wild Boy, if you want to talk about something or vent, you can hit me up. You know, a lot of times because I took psychology in college for a little bit, I look at the psychology of things. So I'll say certain things that are like psychological, where the in-depth of a person's mind in a story, where if they're psychopathic or the tendencies of a human mind is more interesting and more intricate into the story. So, you know, I'll give you different perspectives to look at it, but at the end of the day, it's for fun and everybody likes doing stuff for fun. So,
I got to say thank you for being on. Thank you for always being so awesome to us. Talking to you, listening to your shows has taught me a lot, because I mean, you've been through a lot. It's helped me come to grips with some things as well. So can't tell you how much I appreciate that. And you guys need to be checking out his show every Tuesday. And if not, at least check out that crazy ass chat he has going on over there. Well worth it, my friends. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Anytime. I've gotten people comments from my show saying, when are you going to be on the Fightful stuff? So this is a good thing.
Yeah.
So every Tuesday, the show's name is Wicked Crazy Pinfalls Podcast. It's basically play off of the Boston slang word wicked.
It sure is.
So, but it's just everybody having fun. And if you need to find me, it's throwback978 on Twitter. So it makes it easier.
When I saw the name of your show and I was like, oh, for sure from the Boston area. For sure. But until next time, guys, let us know what your favorite moment from this WrestleMania was, your thoughts on it. We're out.